Okay. Let's see, it is 1:49 and I've been going for 49 minutes and didn't record. Womp, womp, womp. That's why I always need to do the recording when I start. I am so sorry to everybody who's following me remotely. We've been going over polarity. We've been going over bond polarity. And before we did bond polarity, we did a few questions from the Lewis worksheet that we were working on before. We did a couple of examples off the last page. So we did problem number 23 and problem number 26. And they're pretty clear in the notes what's going on. So I'm going to allow you to review the notes. I apologize for skipping over that, but we've just really started to go over bond polarity and set up some definitions of difference in electronegativity. We made a small electronegativity table, and we have now talked about the definition of polar, nonpolar, and ionic as defined by this man-made scale of the difference between two atoms. The good part is what we're getting to right now is really the heart of the matter. This is the easy part, deciding whether a bond is polar or a bond is not polar or a bond is ionic. That part is easy. Molecular polarity is where it gets tough. So that's what we're about to start. And fortunately, I remembered I had not set the recording. So here we are. I apologize, everyone. Molecular polarity. Molecular polarity is about if a molecule is polar or not. And this one is best done by what's called a dichotomous key, a flowchart. A dichotomous key is a decision-making tool that has two, dichotomous, that has two answers. You either answer yes or no, essentially, and you follow it to its conclusion, answering each question yes or no. And eventually you get to the end of it and you decide on how something, the category that something falls into. For this dichotomous key, we ask a series of questions. We ask, does the molecule contain polar bonds? So that means delta electronegativity, which is between 0.4 and 1.7. So we go through and we look at each of the different types of bonds that are in there, and we decide whether or not the bond fits within that scheme. Yes? No. If there are no polar bonds, then the molecule cannot be polar. So we say molecule, not polar. If it does have polar bonds, then the molecule may be polar. And we need to ask another question here. So the next question that we ask is a more difficult question to answer. We ask, is the molecule symmetrical? But what we mean by is the molecule symmetrical is a very special type of symmetry. What we're asking is it AX2, AX3, or AX4, where all X's are the same atom or the same element. In other words, cannot contain E, cannot contain a lone pair. If the answer happens to be yes, then the answer is dipoles cancel. Molecule not polar. If the answer is no, then dipoles add. And they add to a net. I don't want to say net vector, but I'm going to say net dipole. And the molecule is polar. Okay, so this is the flowchart. And the flowchart is easy enough to use once you understand what the flowchart is trying to do and what is being asked here about is the molecule symmetrical. This is the crux of it. And so what I like to do is I like to now take a couple of examples and show what happens when the dipoles cancel. And what is meant by this AX2, AX3, and AX4, where all X's are the same, what winds up happening. And in order to do that, I need to do a little bit of vector math. And I need to convince you of a couple of things. And I think that in seeing the vector math, you're never going to have to do it. But in seeing it, I can use it to convince you of how this flowchart works. And so let me give that a shot for a minute. Let me start off by looking at the typical molecule that we almost always start off with. This is carbon dioxide, CO2. CO2 is a linear molecule. It is an AX2 linear with bond angles of 180 degrees. It has two bonds in it, and so there's only really one type of bond. The bond is a carbon-oxygen bond. The difference in electronegativity is equal to the absolute value of 3.5 subtract 2.5. It's 1.0. That falls in the polar range. Now, this difference in electronegativity, this thing here, is a vector. A vector is a mathematical construct that has magnitude and direction. So what we mean by magnitude and direction is that when I look at the carbon and the oxygen is the 3.5, the carbon is the 2.5. That means that the oxygen is pulling electrons. So the oxygen is the one that is actually tugging on the electrons and pulling it more strongly. So the oxygen winds up getting the partial minus, and the carbon winds up getting the partial plus. And the vector is drawn like this. The vector points along the bond between the carbon and the oxygen. The arrow of the vector is the partial minus side. The tail that we make the plus is actually fairly convenient and shows the plus side. Now I'm using a symbol that I haven't defined yet. I'm using this symbol. This is related to this one. These are both delta. This is capital delta. This is lowercase. They both mean difference. They both mean subtraction or change. But when we use the lowercase delta, it has an additional meaning. It can also mean partial. So while this one means change or difference, the other one can mean change, difference, and is sometimes used for partial, like partial positive charge or partial minus charge. And so it has lots of different meanings, and we're honing in on this partial meaning. And so the magnitude is set by the length. In other words, if I do a vector that's half the size, then I could say that it's half the magnitude, and that these partial positives and partial minuses are smaller than the one above. Okay, so the vector has magnitude. Now, let's take that linear molecule and let's see what happens with it. We know the difference in electronegativity. We know the difference is a difference of 1.0. Oxygen's partial minus. Carbon's partial positive. This is 1.0 and this is 1.0. Notice that they are 180 degrees apart. So what I can do is I can take those vectors and I can image them on an XYZ axis. And as I image them on the XYZ axis, what I do is take and put those vectors, this one going out that direction, because this is the X axis, this is the Y axis. These are only on the x-axis. They have no y-axis component. And because this is minus x in this direction, this is minus 1.0. Vectors get to add. So when I add these vectors together, minus 1.0 plus 1.0 equals 0. This is the net vector. They canceled. They were equal in magnitude and opposite in direction. And so the vectors cancel each other out. What that means is that when I have an AX2 and it is linear, if both the x's are the same, regardless of what the magnitude of the difference is, they will cancel each other out. Does that make sense? And so it doesn't matter how big the dipole moment is. It doesn't matter how many bonds there are. All that matters is that the elements are the same element on either side, and that when they're 180 degrees apart, the dipole moments will cancel each other out. That's the only thing that matters. And so this component up here that we just did is the molecule symmetrical? Is it AX2? If it's AX2 and the elements are the same, then the dipoles cancel and the molecule is not polar. If the elements are not the same, then the molecule, then the dipoles will not cancel. Let's look at one where the dipole moments don't cancel. So let's pick another AX2. Let's do HCN. This is cyanide, hydrogen cyanide gas. And it has a structure that looks like this. It is an AX2. It is 180 degrees. But the difference in electronegativity between the carbon and the nitrogen and the hydrogen and the carbon are different. So this is going to be 3.0 subtract 2.5. And 2.5 subtract 2.2. This one falls in the polar range. This one, nonpolar. And the way that it works is nitrogen is more electronegative. So that's the 0.5. The arrow always points to the negative. And the carbon is more electronegative. So that's my partial minus, my partial positive. And this one is smaller. This one's at 0.3. Okay. When I map those out onto the molecule and I take a look, I'll do sort of a transitional idea here. I'll draw the XY axis. I'll put the carbon in the center, nitrogen, and hydrogen. I'll transition that and we'll take and put the dipole moments in there. So the dipole moments now, one of them goes this way at 0.5, and the other one goes this way at 0.3. They are both pointing the same direction. And so as these vectors add, they're both going in the positive direction. One vector sits here, pointing that way, and one vector sits here, pointing that way, pointing in the same direction. These vectors add, and the result of them adding, they don't subtract from each other. The net result is that they look like this. They start here and go out this way to 0.8. And that is the net vector. And that tells me that HCN, when I look at it, the net vector goes down the molecule. I'll draw it straight down the molecule like that at 0.8. And this molecule is polar. So this is an AX2 where X's are different. And so what happens is on that flow chart up here, I come into AX2, is the molecule symmetrical? Is it AX2 where all X's are the same? No. Dipoles add to a net dipole and the molecule is polar. Does that sort of highlight the differences between those two? Okay. What happens when it's AX3? Now we extend what we just learned to AX3. An easy one to do for AX3 is something symmetrical. Let's do boron. And let's do chlorine. Now, chlorine, I believe the electronegativity was 3.2. I didn't get boron. Boron is 2.0. So my difference in electronegativity equals 3.2 subtract 2.0, 1.2. It's a polar bond. And that means that I have a polar bond with chlorine being more electronegative. I have one running this way, that way, and that way. And the bond angle here is of 120 degrees. So when I map that onto an XYZ axis, and I'm going to turn on a grid. Just to make this a little bit easier for the sake of this argument. So the way this one works is that I've got one that, and let's say it's 1.2. So I'm going to go and say that's one. And let's see if each one of these is 0.5, then I'm just a little bit bigger there. So there's 1.2 in the upwards direction. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to copy that and I'm going to get rid of these lines so that I can rotate it. So I have the same magnitude vector. And I'm going to take it and put it over here on the origin, but I'm going to rotate it to get about that 120 degree bond angle. And then I'm going to copy that, paste it one more time, and try to get it in here at about the same bond angle. Okay, so there we are. There's all three of them. And now when these add, I need to show you how two dipole moments add when they when they're at angles. So the way they add when they're at angles, let's say that what I want to do, let's do a little aside here, how to add vectors. Let's say that I have two vectors that I want to add. One vector is going this direction, and one vector is going this direction, only not that long. If I want to add these two vectors, the way that I do it is I take each of the vectors, I copy it, and I put them head to tail. And I take the red one, and I copy it, and I run it head to tail. Whoops. Except don't shrink it. Revert. The net vector, the sum, is obtained by the diagonal. And so we get the sum by looking at basically the, what is it, the, parallelogram, where both sides are parallel, and we take the diagonal between the two, and that gives us the sum of the two vectors. So we can add and subtract vectors by doing that. We can also, the other way of doing it, here's the other way. So that's a graphical way. This is the technical way. I know there's a lot of technical component to this. We can take a vector and we can find its y component and its x component. And we can do the same thing with the red vector. We can find its y component and its x component if it's in the same spot here. And then the sum of these vectors is the sum of y plus y. So I take this guy and add to it the red y, and that's my y component. And then I sum the two x's. So I can break them up into x, y components. And I can add them together that way. And I get the same result. That helps me to deal with this. Because what I can do here is I can take, this guy just needs to rotate just a little bit more. It's just a little bit off. Come on, rotate. Yeah, that's a little better. What I can do is I can take the x and y components of these and I can add them together. Now notice that what happens is from this point here, this is x. And from this point here, that's minus x. So the x's, I get minus x plus x, the x's go to zero. What happens with the y's? When I look at y, this is plus y. Down here, and right here, this is minus y. But I have to add those two little y components together for the downwards vector. So when I take those two little y components and I add them together, and I take that little arrow that I've just drawn, so there's that arrow that was about the right size. I flip it over, I copy it, I paste in the second one and put it right on top of the first. And then I take that and I measure it. It's usually, or should, be exactly the size of the arrow in the forwards direction. And so what happens is when I add all these together and I look at the y's, what I get is I get plus y minus y going in the downwards direction, and that equals zero. In other words, these dipoles entirely cancel out thanks to the 120 degree bond angle and the fact that they are all equal as they point around the circle. And so there is no net dipole. And this molecule is not polar. If you change one of the x's to be some other element, then all of a sudden the dipoles don't cancel. So if I take and I look at something that looks like this, that is also AX3, but with different x's, then there is a net dipole moment that runs down it and they add together because this dipole moment is fairly strong. And then I've got these two little dipole moments, one that goes this direction that adds there and a little one that goes there. And they add together and they all add into the one dipole moment in the middle. And the molecule becomes polar. So that's where this flow chart comes from. Is it comes from the idea that when the x's are the same, they cancel the dipole moments out. When the x's are different, the dipole moments don't cancel out. And I could go through the same argument for AX4. It's just not worth it. Because the same thing happens, it just happens in three dimensions rather than two dimensions. Okay, so where does that get us then? Once we can tell whether or not a molecule is polar or nonpolar, we can look at a number of different molecules and we can go through just a couple of examples. And we could say, is the molecule polar or is it not? change the paper back to regular blank paper. And let me draw a few molecules and you tell me. What's going on? Let's do okay, I got three molecules here. Maybe I should do a fourth one. Let's do this guy. Okay. Is the molecule polar? Let's do this one is A, B, C, and D. So first off, describe it for me in terms of A, X, and E. Just doing A. How would you describe A? In the AXE sort of geometry. You can unmute, you can throw it in the chat. It's an AX4. Good. AX4 means tetrahedral. Does it have polar bonds? And in fact, what we can do is we can set these up as being the questions. And we could say geometry. We can say polar bonds. And then we could say molecule polar. So the geometry was AX4, that was tetrahedral. Does the molecule contain polar bonds? And how do I know whether it contains polar bonds? I need to look at the two different bonds. I need to look at the carbon hydrogen, and I need to look at the carbon chlorine, and I need to measure the delta electronegativity of those two. So the difference in carbon hydrogen equals 0.3, and the difference in the carbon chlorine equals, let's see, chlorine was 3.2, 2.5, that's 0.7. So does it have polar bonds? And the answer here would be yes, that when we look at this guy, carbon and chlorine, and that 0.7, that's polar. So the answer is yes, it has polar bonds. Is the molecule polar? Here's where we need to ask, if it's polar, is it AX2, AX3, or AX4, where all X's have to be the same? If all x's are the same, the dipoles cancel and it's nonpolar. If all the x's are different, then it is polar. So we would say here, x is different. There's two different types. Interpretation, molecule is polar. So we expect that molecule to be polar. Geometry on the next one, what's B? What's the geometry on B? B is an AX3, and in this case, it has a lone pair. So the lone pair on the nitrogen is what gives it the E. We still need to ask, does it have polar bonds? So the type of bond that we have that we need to worry about is the nitrogen-chlorine bond. Nitrogen is 3.0, chlorine is 3.2. And so this is 3.2 minus 3.0. That's 0.2. That is below the threshold. So that is nonpolar. And if the molecule does not have polar bonds, then the molecule cannot be polar. So when there are no polar bonds, we don't even need to worry about the geometry. The geometry doesn't matter. There must be polar bonds, and then we worry about the geometry. If there's no polar bonds, geometry doesn't matter. The last one is an AX3E. So that E is on the center element. That's that guy. We've got two different types of bonds to worry about. We have the OS bond, and we have the SCL bond. The OS is 3.5 subtract, I forgot what sulfur is. Let's go back and look. 2.6. So that's 0.9. And the sulfur and chlorine, that's going to be 3.2 subtract 2.6. That's going to equal, 0.6? They're both polar. Both bonds are polar. Now the question is the molecule polar? So we go back to the definition, we go back to the flowchart. It's an AX3E. As an AX3E, with the E in there, it breaks the symmetry. Is the molecule symmetrical? Is it AX2, AX3, or AX4, where all the X's are the same? Cannot contain E. If it has an E in it, the molecule cannot be symmetrical. We go over to the no. Molecule is polar. The dipoles will not cancel in this molecule. And that molecule is polar. The last one is an AX4. It has carbon hydrogen. The difference in electronegativity is 0.3. That's a nonpolar bond. That immediately tells me that the molecule is nonpolar, and I don't need to do anything else. Once there are no polar bonds, the no polar bonds indicates that the molecule is nonpolar. Thank you, Maria. AX4 was right. Okay, does that give you an idea how to do molecular polarity? This is molecular polarity on a small molecule. What do we do on a larger molecule? What do we do on something that maybe looks like this? This is multiple centers. What do we do when we have multiple centers? And the answer is, if there are polar bonds, the molecule is always polar. With multiple centers, the dipoles can't cancel. And so the minute that we see that there's polar bonds, for instance, the polar bond in this molecule is the carbon-oxygen bond here. This bond is the polar bond. And the rest of them are nonpolar. So these bonds here going to the carbons, these bonds are nonpolar. But all it needs to do is contain one polar bond. And the dipole moments can't cancel because you have multiple centers. And so the molecule becomes polar. So when you have a multiple center molecule and it has polar bonds within it, then the molecule is polar. So it's fairly easy to do at that point. And the last part of that is taking it back to melting points and boiling points. And that goes to the IMF forces. The IMF forces, depending upon your instructor, they use different names, but they start off at the lowest level with van der Waal forces. Sometimes these are called London dispersion forces. Sometimes they just call them London or dispersion, or sometimes they call them induced. All of these are the same name. They're just different names that they give to this idea of the lowest possible intermolecular attractive force. Above these, we get to dipole-dipole. Above dipole-dipole, hydrogen bonding. And above that, ionic. So these differences, what do these different things really mean? Ionic means cation and anion. So I have a metal, which is a cation, and a non-metal, which is the anion. So I actually have electrostatic attraction ionic charges. Dipole-dipole is a molecule that has polarity to the molecule and has partial positives and partial minuses, and they align up like little bar magnets. And so the partial minus, if I go with partial minus as being blue, it's aligning with the partial positive, and it's like the poles of a magnet. There's electrostatic attraction between the partials. Okay, so that leaves hydrogen bonding and van der Waals forces for us to deal with and what those differences are. Hydrogen bonding is more or less the hardest to explain. The van der Waals is a little bit easier. So with the van der Waals, what we do is we start off with something that is symmetrical. And this is the electron cloud. Electrons normally repel each other. And as these guys get closer together, what winds up happening is they morph. The electrons slide over to one side. That makes one side of this partial minus and the other side partial positive. The other incoming ion, or the other incoming molecule, I should say, has the same thing sort of happen. It morphs because it sees the electron cloud. So its electrons slide over and they induce a tiny dipole. So this dipole is fleeting and temporary, and it is induced by being in close proximity. And it goes back and forth. The minute that they go far enough apart, they go back to being normal. So these are very weak forces because they're temporary and induced. The dipole-dipole are fairly strong because they've got this little bar magnet in them. The ionic is the strongest because they're full-on positive and negative charges. That leads me to hydrogen bonding. Hydrogen bonding is a special dipole-dipole. Hydrogen bonding is where I have a hydrogen which is connected to an oxygen or a nitrogen or some other really strong electronegative element. The oxygen bears a very large partial minus and the hydrogen a very large partial plus. The hydrogen is electron deficient. It has lost lots of electrons. It's so hungry for electrons that it can borrow some electron density from another oxygen. And in so doing, in borrowing that electron density, it makes an attractive force that we call a hydrogen bond. That hydrogen bond is just the donation of the oxygen, giving its partial minus to the hydrogen's partial positive. And so it only happens when I see OH, NH, FH. These are the main ones, with the rest of a molecule that's in there. Those things can have then hydrogen bonding. So now what I need to do is I need to rank these, or the way that I set this up is that van der Waals forces, these are forces that are used by nonpolar molecules. Dipole-dipole, these are polar molecules. Hydrogen bonding, these are polar molecules with OH, NH, and FH. And then ionic, these are things that have metals. Because the metals are the things that tell you that this thing is actually ionic. As soon as you see the metal in there and the non-metal, we know that it's ionic. And those IMF forces can then tell you about which material is higher boiling or lower boiling, or higher melting or lower melting. All right, how are we doing? Are you guys following? Is this making sense? In terms of transition of going from polar bonds to polar molecules to now evaluating the IMF forces and using the IMF forces to then determine whether or not something is higher boiling or lower boiling. So one of the things that we can do is we can talk about what boiling is and what melting is. When we look at a solid is a regularly organized material that's a crystalline material. Each of these particles is moving around, but they are constrained to move in a little tiny circle. They cannot translate from one location to another. It's basically stuck in that little sphere. It's stuck in that sphere by the IMF forces, by the attractive forces. When we put more energy into it, what we do is we increase the motion. And as we increase the motion, the particle can overwhelm the attractive forces. And as it does, it gets more mobility and it can go into a liquid. The liquid is usually contained in some container, but the particles now get to freely move throughout the volume of the container, and they can move in any direction and they can bounce off things and change direction and go anywhere they like. If I add even more heat, then I can convert them into a gas. And the gas, now they have escaped all the attractive forces and they are free to move throughout any distance that they want. And in order to transition from solid to liquid or liquid to gas, I have to add enough heat to overwhelm the attractive forces. So to change phase, must add enough heat to overwhelm IMFs. The stronger the IMF, the more heat required. So that means the higher up on this scale I am in terms of my stronger IMFs, the more heat is required to move from solid to liquid to gas. And when I go from solid to liquid, this is melting. When I go from liquid to gas, this is boiling. So the higher the IMF, the higher the melting point. The higher the IMF, equals the higher boiling point. So if I know the IMFs involved, then I can tell which one is higher boiling or lower boiling, or which one is higher melting or lower melting. So if I take some compounds now, I could give you a couple of compounds. And I can ask you which one of these has the higher boiling point. So all we need to do is we need to decide, number one, is the molecule polar or nonpolar? Type of IMF. Decide stronger IMF equals higher boiling point. So you could decide the type of IMF without knowing that the molecule is polar or nonpolar. But it's easier if you decide if the molecule is polar or nonpolar. So first off, these are multicenters. So all we need to know is there a polar bond? And we've done the polar bonds here quite a bit. So we could go through and we could do the delta electronegativity. The carbon oxygen equals 3.5 and 2.5 is 1.0. Carbon hydrogen equals 0.3. And it's the same for each. Carbon oxygen. Oh, except there's one other bond in here. Carbon hydrogen equals 0.3, and I have an oxygen hydrogen bond, which equals 2 and 3.5. So that is 1.7. I think I'm at. Went the wrong way. Okay. So there's my differences in electronegativity. So what do I expect on A? Let's say that this one is A. This one is B. Is A polar or nonpolar? What do you think? The CO is definitely polar, Maria. Good. That one's definitely polar. The other one is nonpolar. The CH bond is nonpolar. But what about, we haven't decided, we can see that the CO bond here is polar and this OH bond is polar. So both of these seem to be polar. So is the molecule polar or nonpolar? These are multicenters. Dipoles can't cancel. So if the dipoles can't cancel, what does that say about both A and B? Are they polar or are they nonpolar? The overall molecule. 1.3 is polar, yes. But what about the molecule? Is the molecule polar or is the molecule not polar? What happens here is because they're multi-centered, they have a polar bond. They're multi-centered. Because they're multi-centered, the dipoles can't cancel. So same thing here, multi-centered, dipoles can't cancel. So they are both polar molecules. So I'm going to answer down here. Both polar molecules. Type of IMFs. What type of IMF does A use? What is a polar molecule? Now we just need to go back here. What is a polar molecule used for IMFs? What type of IMF does a polar molecule have? Dipole-dipole. Good, Johnny. That's right. So A is going to have dipole-dipole. What about B? B is also polar. Is B going to have dipole-dipole? It will. This is also dipole-dipole. Okay. Well, if they both have dipole-dipole and they both have the same number of atoms, then I would expect them to have the same boiling point. But this one is asking me which one is higher boiling point. So there must be something different. So what can I look at? If they're both polar, it looks like there are two different types of polar. There's polar molecules with OH, NH, and FH. These can do hydrogen bonding. And then there's polar that can't do that. So maybe there's two different types of polar, and maybe I should review these two molecules a little bit more. Are there any differences between these two molecules? What about this? On the left-hand side, we see that there's an oxygen connected to two carbons. On the right-hand side, we see that there's an oxygen that is connected to a hydrogen, and on the other side, a carbon. But it's really the oxygen connected to the hydrogen that is of importance here. The oxygen connected to the hydrogen allows for a hydrogen bond. So what we see if I draw these two molecules is that we see that there's a dipole moment that runs down the center of the molecule, which allows these molecules to sort of stack up this way. And the attractive force between the molecules is a dipole-dipole force. The other molecule has a structure that looks like this. And this structure allows for the hydrogen bond to occur between the hydrogen that is partial positive and the oxygen that is partial minus. And so this piece is the hydrogen bond. This guy over here is weaker, and this one is stronger. This one is going to take more force, more energy to pull apart. This one is going to take less energy. Just simply based on their boiling point, or based on their IMF forces, one being dipole-dipole and the other one being a hydrogen bond. Okay. And so when we go back and we say which one is higher boiling, the higher boiling one is the stronger IMF forces. So that one's going to be higher boiling. How much higher boiling? The boiling points for these are about minus 32 degrees Celsius for its boiling point. And the boiling point over here is about 78 degrees Celsius, positive 78, minus 32 versus positive 78. And it has to do with the differences in their intermolecular attractive forces. So, as I said, this is a complicated thing. You've got to pull together many different skill sets all of a sudden to be able to do this. We've got to be able to ascertain what is a polar bond. Oh, starting from here, we've got to be able to figure out what a polar bond is by working from the differences in the electronegativity. Once you figure out what a polar bond is, then you need to apply that to the molecular polarity. You need to then decide if the molecule is polar. Once you decide if the molecule is polar, then after we've got molecular polarity, then we've got to be able to figure out where it sits on this IMF scale of what type of IMF it uses. And that's determined by looking at the types of bonds that it has in it, whether the molecule is polar or nonpolar, or whether it can do hydrogen bonding, or whether it has a metal in it and it's ionic. And these are stronger increasing forces as I look. And then once I figure out which one has the stronger IMFs, then I can figure out whether it has, which one has the higher melting point or the higher boiling point. And that's the way, and I go through and I do these. So that's kind of where you guys all are in terms of sitting in Lucas's class and Cisco's class. And I think you're all working in sort of the same area. So this is definitely something to watch. Although I will say that as much importance as we put on it, on the test, it generally takes a slight background to much of the calculations that you would normally do on a test. So when you go into the test, the types of things that you might see more are some of the, you'll see the Lewis dot structures. You'll see the electron configurations. You'll see the stoichiometry calculations. And oftentimes you'll see more of the stoichiometry calculations than you will see these conceptual types of questions. But these conceptual types of questions will definitely be there. They will add up. And if you don't know how to do them, you'll definitely get tagged and lose a bunch of points. So this is worth spending a bit of time on, even though I know that this is more complicated than some of the other things that we've done, because it ties so many different concepts together. That's the hard part. All right, I'm looking at the clock, it's 3 o'clock. Are there any questions you guys have in going through this?
I think I'm okay. I was using the crash course for the Lewis structure at the beginning of the class. So
yeah,
I'm just keep working that, practicing for tomorrow's exam.
Okay, cool. That sounds good. All right, you guys.
Thank you very much.
All right, take care.
Bye.